Julia Sweeney was a regular on Saturday Night Live who went on to more autobiographical comedy. Her latest book is on motherhood, a good match with her latest movie role as the voice of Mrs. Squibbles, the well-meaning mother of one of the college-age monsters in this summer's Disney Pixar movie, Monsters University.
Scary.
Have fun, kids! I'll just be here listening to my tunes.
Monstrous yet sweet, not unlike Sweeney's own experiences with being a mother in her book, If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother. I'm Jim Meadows, and Julia Sweeney is on this encore edition of Focus. It's coming up after the news. Good morning, I'm Jim Meadows, and this is Focus on WYLL. You're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous Focus program. While we're not taking calls this hour, you can join our conversation on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Julia Sweeney has made her living portraying fictional characters in TVs and movies, from her work on Saturday Night Live to her upcoming vocal work in Monsters University in June. But she's also known for telling stories in both a funny and often very serious way about her real life in works like God Said Ha and Letting Go of God. And in her new book, If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother, which is about the totally safe, non-controversial, nothing-can-go-wrong topic of motherhood. And Julia Sweeney, it's a pleasure to have you on Focus today.
Thank you. I love that introduction.
You know, one of the things as I was reading the book, one of the first things that really struck me in the book was your expression of your desire. Is that the right word? Need? You wanted to be a mother. There was no doubt.
Yeah, I really, like, it's funny now that I am a mother, I look back and I think, oh, it wasn't so important. Like, I'm not trying to diminish my experience being a mother, which has been fantastic, transformative, everything you can imagine. But I also think, you know, I have so many friends who chose not to have kids or ended up not having kids for whatever reason, and their lives seem really great, too. And so now I look back and think, wow, but I really did just, I couldn't rest. I couldn't think of anything else until I was a mom.
When did that begin? Did you want to be a mom when you were 18, or was it something that developed?
No, I didn't. In fact, Well, when I was really young, I wanted to be a mom of 7 kids. I had that was my fantasy. I think that's what an ambitious girl did. You know, that was her fantasies when you were in a Catholic, you know, culture, and you wanted to do a lot. Well, what could you do? You could have a lot of kids. But then once I was an adult, I was actually terrified of the idea of having kids because I felt so hell-bent on having a career in something other than a traditional way. That was really important to me. And then, sort of ironically, or maybe it's just an insight into my screwed-up personality, once I had cancer and I had a hysterectomy and I absolutely couldn't have a kid, that's when, I guess, it had to be a certain amount of challenging for me to become a mother in order for the desire to really kick in. I don't know.
And so, You've answered my second question. I do want to let everybody know we welcome you to the conversation as well here in Focus. And if you have a question for Julia Sweeney, call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WYLL, 800-222-WYLL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Well, I'm going to skip ahead to the book. In the book, I hope it's not too much of a giveaway, that you have a beautiful, smart daughter now. And she's how old?
She's 13 and a half now.
And, well, what was the big adjustment for you between wanting a child and actually having a child?
Just about every single thing you could imagine.
And we should say, for starters, of course, you adopted.
I adopted Mulan. She was about a year and a half when I adopted her from southern China. And in just a positive, wonderful way, it really did fill the need. I wanted to be a mom, and it absolutely, that itch was scratched in the deepest way, and I don't mean to make light of it. It was really what I wanted, and I totally got it. And that almost never happens in life, so I have to say that was great. But other than that, I was really naive about what it took. I really thought I would just kind of carry on my normal life, which was quite busy and filled with a lot of work and unpredictable work and many, many hours work and a social life. I mean, I was 40, 42 by the time I met Mulan. So, and I thought I would kind of just add a kid to my life. I didn't really understand what it took to be a mom at first.
And I don't know, maybe for a lot of new mothers, that's just what happens. It's totally new.
Yeah, I don't even know if you can. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's a bad analogy, but the one that's just jumped into my head is going to war. Like, there's no way you can really really prepare somebody for it.
Did you have a network of other mothers, even your own mother, to compare notes with?
No. Well, my own mom I was in contact with on the phone, but she lived 1,000 miles away. And really, all my friends were childless. You know, they were, some of them were in couples, some weren't, but you know, I didn't really have any close friends with little kids. So having a little kid threw me into a whole other world. Like, you know, when I went to the preschool, that's where I met other people who had little kids. Like, when I went to the park, that's where I met mothers who had little kids. But I didn't have, for whatever reason, I really just didn't have friends with little kids. I didn't really know what it was like.
Is that part of the just part of being in show business, that you're working with people who have delayed or put off or have decided not to be parents? And so
I guess, you know, that would be an interesting scientific study, because I felt like in comedy, you know, my closer friends in comedy were either men who were gay and not having kids at that time. Now all the gay people are having kids, but at that time they weren't. Then or they were other men who were delaying getting married until they had enough success to do it, which made them even older than me to have kids. And then the women were I'm thinking of all these women that were my close friends, like Kathy Griffin, or they just weren't doing it. You know, like, so really my closest friends were not, I didn't really have close friends who were having kids.
It's interesting. And, you know, once you had a kid, this is a kid you adopted, and I guess if you have a kid who is of your blood, then you assume that, or maybe you only project that kid is going to be somewhat like you, or somewhat like the father, or someone like some relative.
Right. I think that you probably think you have an understanding of the swath of personality you might get if it's biological. Although I think that's kind of a bunch of bull, because I don't think anyone knows what they're getting. I really feel like the human species has a whole range of personalities that, you know, yes, some of it might be inherited, but I think you're just as likely to have a kid with a personality completely opposite to you as you are to adopt a kid who has a personality, you know, not like you or like you.
Well, some of the funniest parts of the book, and now that she's the age to have opinions about it, I hope Mulan likes the way she's depicted.
I hope so too.
But you know, she's a person who knows what she wants. She's ready to even at a very young age to state her opinions and wants and needs.
Yes. I have one chapter in there about her as a backseat driver in a car seat, telling me that I should be taking a right or getting in a different lane because I was, you know, I could get ahead of the car in front of me or something.
Now, I'll tell you, I can remember being a little kid in the backseat of the car, and I just assumed that my parents were gods behind the wheel and nothing was going to go wrong.
Yeah, you know what? I think I had that feeling too. But she absolutely, from an early age, surveyed the landscape and had opinions about how things should go, often that were not the way it was going.
We are on Focus, and I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking with Julia Sweeney. Her new book is If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And you can also find out more about her at juliasweeney.com, where you are also blogging. And I gather that some of the material in this book may have been worked out in different forms in the blog.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Even though, actually, as a rule of thumb, I try not to do that, but sometimes things just happen that are out of my control. Like, during, you know, the conceit of the book is that I get 4 weeks alone, which is actually what happened. I didn't really write the book in the 4 weeks, but I did have 4 weeks alone where I, you know, gathered up old essays that I'd written a long time ago and kind of put together this narrative thinking about how I got in this situation. And in the third week of that time, I had a brother die. And so I didn't know at first if I should even include it in the book. And he was somebody who had a lot of drug and alcohol problems and was sort of expected to probably die for like 10 years. So in some ways it wasn't a surprise, and in some ways it was a terrible surprise. But I almost stopped the book, but then my editor was saying, oh, just keep writing. And so I wrote a blog entry about him, and that blog entry does end up in the book. So that's one example where I did use a blog entry for a chapter.
Does that sort of, you know, does that sort of technology, because, of course, you're writing in your blog about things that wouldn't go into a book. You're writing about books you read, for instance.
Well, actually, I came up with that idea because I wanted to stop writing about my personal life on my blog. I wanted to save that and create a narrative that could be a book like this one. And then I think I went on David Byrne's blog, which I haven't even been on since I went on it. This is like several years ago. And he was talking about books he was reading and movies he was seeing. And I thought, oh, my God, that's so interesting. Like, I really like to know what people are reading and watching. And so then I kind of came up with this idea that I would just put the books in that I've read and the movies I've seen, and that's how I would do my blog.
Okay. Let me go to the first of our callers, and we, on line one, we're talking, excuse me, on line four, we're talking to Stephen Champagne. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call, enjoying the conversation this morning. I'm in my mid-50s, but I do remember Julia Sweeney on Saturday Night Live. I want to say the role of Pat, I don't think it's possible, but I want to say it was some 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, two quick questions. How did you come up with the character? I mean, was that something that just kind of you came up with, or was it worked on? And then the other question is, I'm assuming you didn't say this, but I'm assuming you're a single parent, and I was wondering how difficult it was to adopt. And I'll go ahead and listen offline. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, yeah. Well, first, I didn't really think of doing a character that was of indeterminate gender when I came up with Pat. It was more like there was a couple of people, a female and a male, and actually another male, but it was just sort of this group of people that I worked with, because I used to work as an accountant when I started taking improv classes at the Groundling Theater in Los Angeles when I was starting out. And I wanted to be this kind of obnoxious character that I had worked with as an accountant before, and I couldn't totally pull it off as a guy. I wasn't really sure if it was a guy or a woman. And then I thought, oh, well, maybe that's the joke, you know, maybe the joke. And it was really to kind of cover for my lack of ability to really convincingly be a guy. Then once I started doing the character, that became the big joke. Like, the audience latched onto that, so that's how it started. And then I did it on SNL after I had done that character at the Groundlings. But that was fun. And then the second question, well, I'm not a single parent now. I got married to my husband Michael when Mulan was 8.
And that is in the book. I've been holding stuff back.
And so I've kind of had the experience of being a single mom and a married mom, and it's definitely, it's kind of funny because Mulan said to me recently, I can't believe that you went to China and decided that you were going to adopt a baby all on your own. Like, she's really conservative that way. Like, mom, you need a mom and a dad. Or, you know, you need two parents, because we also have friends that are gay that have kids. And she can see that. And I agree with that now. Like, no, I don't think people should be prevented from adopting because they're single by any stretch. But I didn't understand what a big project I was taking on. You really should have a group. Actually, it's more than two, I think. I think you need like 5 adults to commit to this kid.
You do talk about, and I think you referred to it, you had to scale back or at least change the work that you do so that you could care for your daughter.
Yeah, well, I mean, I knew I'd have to have childcare because I had, you know, to work and make a living. But I was really naive and unrealistic about the kind of work that I had done. Like, I would rush off and do, like, I'd guest star on an episode of a TV show, or I would take writing jobs where people would write till midnight every night. And I didn't realize how many hours I was working, because in show business your work is so mercurial, and you, sometimes you don't work at all and sometimes you work a lot. I didn't realize, I thought I didn't work that much, and it's, and I really had to be available all the time, which means that I had to have a babysitter, you know, a nanny that was available all the time, which is what happened. But then I realized I really didn't like that, because, you know, that was a big revelation to me, that I wanted to be a full-time mom. Like, I really, I liked it. I really liked being with her all the time, and I feel like having a kid is such a huge project that they really deserve a full-time parent. Now, that doesn't mean I don't think somebody should be away from them from time to time in order not to kill them, but I didn't, I was surprised to have that attitude.
So, but you're working less or differently now, but you're still working, right?
Yeah. I mean, now Mulan goes to school, and, you know, I try to get in my few hours of writing every day, which always seems like a Herculean feat just to get that in every day. But I do, it's really important to me to be home when she's home from school. And that means that I can only take certain kinds of work. And you know, now I'm married, so, like, for example, this last weekend I went to L.A. because they had a book festival, the L.A. Times Book Festival, and, of course, my husband's home with my daughter. So now I have somebody to help that is invested in her and her future, a parent, not a babysitter. But, you know, so I'm mixing it up. You know, like, I'm kind of, you know, cobbling it together. But mostly I feel like now that she's 13, I feel like, okay, it's only 5 more years. Really, that isn't that long. Like, I'm in it. Like, I want to be home every day when she gets home from school until she goes to college.
So, for if your agent came calling and saying, "Well, we have a regular role for you in a sitcom," that would probably be a not happening.
No. Well, first of all, I don't live in L.A. anymore, so that's where most of those jobs are. And you know what? It's like, even as you say that, my mouth was forming the word yes, just to show you how much crap that I'm full of. I don't know. I do like being here. I'm in the Chicago area now, and I do like being home, but I miss working in show business too, so I'm not sure how I'd react if something like that happened, actually.
Now, I don't know if you could hear during the opening of the show, I played a clip from Monsters University.
Oh, uh-huh.
Where you are the voice of one of the parents, one of
yes.
the college monsters' parents,
yes.
Mrs. Squibbles.
Yes.
And I heard that voice. I've met Mrs. Squibbles. I think I've met a few. I don't know how to describe it, but tell me about, I assume it may have already been written for you, but how did you develop the voice for it?
Well, it's really just an exaggeration of my own voice. It's kind of like the voice I used, you know, when I first started taking improv classes at the Groundling Theater. You know, of course, I played a lot of moms on stage, partly because I like those kind of characters. I think the look that I happen to have is a very mom-like look. I'm kind of round and motherly looking. And I played a lot of parts like that. And I really just kind of, I was kind of making fun of my own mom's voice and other mom's voices. And now, of course, I am that voice. Like, I really have aged into just that is my voice.
I get the impression of, you know, not having seen the rest of the movie beyond the trailer, but that voice and the character seems to make me think of the sort of mother. It's sort of like, no matter how cool the kid is trying to be, she's going to be
yeah.
their mother no matter what.
Yeah, it's like, oh, boys, come in and let me give you some cupcakes, that kind of voice.
And in the meantime, she's cranking up the window and listening to Black Sabbath, as far as I could tell.
Yes, I know. She's a woman of contradictions.
Now, that's doing that sort of voice work. I was just wondering how that works out. That's not quite the same thing as acting, you know, acting in a movie or on stage with other people. Are you just alone with the room and the director, or were you working with other actors?
Well, in the case of this, I mean, Pixar is kind of like the creme de la creme of getting a voiceover job. I've done a lot of voiceover parts on different series and stuff. Nothing right now, but I've been like a regular character on different shows. Anyway, and And it's always different. You know, every time it's different. But with Pixar, oh boy, they flew me and my family out to the Pixar Studios, which is near Palo Alto in sort of San Francisco and Emeryville. And I recorded there with a director, and it was very intensive. And but it wasn't with the other actors because I don't know, they didn't do it that way. But and that was really fun. And then that was a couple years ago, maybe more than 2 years ago. And then there have been little refinements. You know, they added a scene or took out a scene, or they added a little prequel, not a prequel, but like a little film in the film or something, and we had to record that. And I did that from here in Chicago, where they would kind of patch me through. And in the old days, you wouldn't see people. You'd hear the director in your headphones and then do the part. But now video conferencing is so, you know, ubiquitous and easy that they have big screens. And, you know, the thing is, you really do feel like you're in the room with the director. So that's kind of how that one went.
I've read about voice work where the actors say someone in the Mel Blanc days or something would be asked to give, you know, really several different approaches to a line so that...
Oh, yeah. They do that. Like, they'll have a line like, say, let's go to the store, just to make up something up. And then you'll do it until you're just exhausted. Like, I'll do, let's go to the store. Let's go to the store. Let's go to the store. And then they pick out later what fits into their mood the most.
You yourself, you started, at least one of your early work was an improv comedy with the Groundlings.
Yes.
And, of course, you know, people here in Illinois, we think of improv comedy, we first think of, like, Second City.
Yeah,
but the Groundlings is out on the West Coast?
Yeah, it's in Los Angeles. It's still going. And, you know, now there's other places, too. You know, Upright Citizens Brigade, and there's Second City in L.A. now. But when I was... This is like, 1984, when I was working as an accountant in Los Angeles, and I realized I really didn't want to be an accountant, even though I did.
Was accountancy originally, that was not your day job, that was your career originally?
Oh, yeah. You know, I had my economics degree from the University of Washington, and I don't know what I thought. I came to L.A. absolutely not to be an actress, but to be an accountant. That was my dream, and I achieved my dream. And I worked at Columbia Pictures, which no longer exists, but and I was in the area called participation accounting, and it was my first job out of college. And, you know, I wore a suit every day, and I had pumps that matched my suits, and I did my accounting. And then after a few years, and I really did enjoy it, actually, I realized that to get ahead, I had to either get an MBA or a law degree to really move ahead, and I didn't really like it that much. Like, I enjoyed it, but I didn't love it, and I started kind of having a little bit of a midlife crisis, like at the age of 25, and I read a review of the Groundling Theater, and it said they taught classes, and that they taught classes for non-professionals, to people who'd never done acting before. And, you know, I'd done stuff in high school, but I hadn't really pursued acting. And so I went into classes, and immediately I knew I would give up everything to do it. It was just an immediate... And, by the way, I wasn't even that good. It wasn't because I was good.
Well, you must
have... I just liked it. I loved it.
But you must have gotten better.
Yes, I flunked the first class. There was, like, three. There was, like, beginning, intermediate... advanced, and then they had a writing lab, and then you could audition to get into the Sunday Company. That's their kind of farm team. And then you could, and from there, and only a few people from each level went to the next level. But my first level was taught by Phil Hartman, and he flunked me.
Flunked by Phil
Hartman?
Well,
he didn't flunk me. We used to joke about that, but he didn't pass me. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
And he said, you should repeat it. And he said, let me just tell you, if you repeat this class, you'll get to be one of the better ones in the class instead of... Because I really didn't understand anything about improv. And it was really the most loving thing in the world that he made me repeat that class. Because then I did get to be one of the better ones, and I got a lot of confidence from repeating it. And then I definitely changed my whole life. I quit my accounting job. I had to go back, of course, because I had to earn a living. But I really changed my life to pursue acting.
And the rest is history.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Let me go to line one, and Paul in Champaign is on the line. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Yeah. I wanted to, I guess since it's on public radio, we should, and maybe you did give proper to the, at the time, the most popular This American Life, which was your telling of your studying Catholic.
Yeah. I don't think it's still the most popular, but for a
Well, I mean, the whole show is much more popular, so obviously, but at the time it was.
Yeah. At the time, Ira would always say, you are our most popular show.
Uh-huh.
We're talking about letting go of God, I assume.
Yes.
Right. As a person who, you know, had my knuckles wrapped in the cloakroom by Sister Virgilia of the Adorers of the Precious Blood, I can empathize a lot. And it was quite important to hear that, the approach you took. And it was very seditious to undermine, you know, the New Testament as you did. So I just wanted to ask, thank you very much for it, and see what you're doing, whether you're how you're coping with your ex and avalanche Catholicism, as I like.
Well, I'm still wrestling with it. Not in terms of wondering what I believe. I'm pretty much settled on my confidence in there not being a God. But that part of it, I don't really go over so much anymore. But I do think a lot about it. And in fact, I have a couple of books that I'm trying to write actually simultaneously, which may be a good or bad idea. But anyway, one of them is called My Beautiful Loss of Faith Story, where I kind of go over, because I did all this, you know, now that started in like 98 for me when I started questioning my belief. And then I put the show up in 2004, and it's just sort of like going over everything that happened, what it was like to perform it, and then kind of finding the whole atheist movement, all the atheist conferences that I went to, and I don't want to say I'm disillusioned with that, because I'm not, and I absolutely am an atheist, and I have the same worldview as those people, but there was a period of disillusionment with that as well. I think it's an interesting story, because now I'm at a place where I am about to join a church. I think I'm going to join the Unitarian Universalist Church in Evanston, which is close to where I live. And I think that church is important for reasons that have nothing to do with whether there's a God or not. I think community, ritual, you know, being in service to others in an organized way, in a culture that understands religion, is important. So I've kind of changed not my thinking about God, but my feeling about being as part of an organized movement.
I see. Well, you know the joke about the Unitarians, and maybe you can put it on your cover, which is the burning question mark on your yard, that they come out and do that. Thanks a lot.
But I actually don't find them that way. Like, when you go to the services, I mean, it's easy to make fun of, but I believe it. It's my worldview. It's like, the songs are like, you know, there's trees and grass, and then there's other trees and grass. You know? But that's true.
Okay. Well, I think the Unitarian, or is it Universalist Unitarians? But I think they'll be happy to have you.
Well, I'm still thinking about it. I mean, I have to say that I'm also sort of a misanthrope at the same time. Like, I say all this stuff about joining and doing everything, and then I think, really, I just want to be alone on Sunday and read in my house. So I have to kind of find a way to balance both my desires.
This could be a big challenge.
I know. Maybe it's going every other Sunday.
It's time for a short break. We'll be back in a moment with Julia Sweeney. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous program. Good morning, I'm Jim Meadows, and this is Focus on WILL. You're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous Focus program. While we're not taking calls this hour, you can join our conversation on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. We're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, here with Julia Sweeney, whose new book is called If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother, published by Simon & Schuster, about her own experience as a mother, among other things. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook. at Focus 580. Julia, I was wondering, you write in your book about meeting your husband in what I imagine could be one of the most potentially spooky ways possible.
It's true.
Could you tell us this story, please?
Yes. Well, I was doing Letting Go of God, and Ira Glass had just, so this is the perfect story after our last question. Ira Glass did an excerpt on This American Life. It was a big popular thing, and I was getting really hundreds of emails. I never added them up, but it seemed like thousands of emails, like from people, almost all of them positive. And it was all just about my struggle with church and stuff like that, and supportive, I should say, the emails were. But I couldn't even really read them all. I was working on Desperate Housewives at the time as a writer, and I was running in my office in between meetings and story meetings and writing scenes for the show, and getting hundreds of emails. Like, it was just incredible, the amount of emails. And one of the emails that I got, the headline said, "Desperately Seeking Sweeney-in-Law." And the first line was, "I'm writing to you to propose marriage to you on behalf of my brother, who doesn't know I'm writing to you. But his big deal breaker with women is they cannot be religious in any way. So you're the perfect woman for him, and don't worry, our family is just as crazy as yours." And it was a very cute letter, and he said, I would propose to you myself, but I'm gay and live in San Francisco, so I don't think that would work. But here's my brother." And it was just this very cute letter. And I read it to the guys in the office next to me, but I didn't respond because, you know, I'm not going to write this brother. And I thought if I wrote the brother who wrote the letter, he would say, "I really just want to say cute letter, you know, thanks for writing, but I'm not going to write your brother." But I just did nothing. Then, like, 6 months later, I was in New York doing Letting Go of God, and I was turning in my microphone at the end of the show to the sound guy, and I ran into this woman who was leaving the show, but she wasn't planning to talk to me. And she said, "Oh, a friend of mine wrote you a letter about 6 months ago proposing marriage on behalf of his brother." And I said, "Oh, right." And she was like, "Well, I just want to vouch for those two brothers. I've known them since high school, and they're very funny and interesting. You should write the brother." And I said, "Maybe I will." And she's like, "You should." And I was like, "Maybe I will." And then I didn't, because I thought, "Oh, come on, I'm not going to write this brother." And then another 6 months went by, and I was doing Letting Go of God in L.A., again, a different run of the show. And I left one of the shows, and in the lobby was this handsome guy. And he said, "Oh, I wrote you a letter a year ago proposing marriage on behalf of my brother." And I said, "Oh, right. You know, I said, I'm sorry I never wrote your brother." And he said, "Oh, no, I'm glad you never wrote him, because he's a big jerk." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, when he found out I wrote you that letter, he absolutely went crazy. He was so angry because he put his, you know, cell phone number in there and his picture and everything, and he was very upset." And he said, "Now my whole family's mad at me. Even my mom came to your show, and she won't even meet you in the lobby because she thinks this is so crazy." So I said, "Okay, I have to meet your mother." So then I went and over and met Norma, and she was hilarious. I have to say, I kind of fell for the mother first, which I think is a good way to go, people.
Go for if you
go
can
for the mom.
If you can make friends with the future in-laws.
If you like the mom, the son is going to be good. Okay, so she was so funny and interesting. The brother was funny and interesting. So I went home, found the email, wrote to the brother, and mainly my idea wasn't to, you know, say, hey, but to just say, "Oh, don't be mad at your brother for writing this email to me. It was funny," and, you know, and so I wrote him, and then he wrote back, and we wrote back and back and back and back and back and back, and then eventually he came to L.A. for a visit, and he was, sparks flew, and a couple of years later we got married.
I have to admit, it was about this time in the book when I was reading about this, I was thinking, if your agent isn't shopping this around for a movie, he's crazy.
I don't know.
There's rom-com in here somewhere.
I don't know. But you know what? I will say this just this morning, because, you know, when you're a public figure, I have my website. I get great emails from people. I try to respond to everyone. But, of course, there's the nuts, you know. And I was reading just this morning this crazy email from this guy in Denmark who keeps writing me. And I even wrote back and said, "Thank you for writing me about your art, but, you know, I'm not really interested in it." And, you know, and now, but he just keeps writing, and he has these really pretentious ways he describes his art. And Michael said something like, "You better not respond to that guy. You don't know what kind of nuts are out there. It could ruin your whole life," or something like that. And we both started laughing.
Oh, geez. Well, here's someone I'm sure is quite sane on line one. Bobby in Champaign, good morning. You're on Focus.
don't know about the sane part, but we'll let that go. Julia, you are just absolutely one of my favorite performers. And I died laughing when I saw God Said Ha. So I wanted to get the movie, but it's really expensive. It's not like your run-of-the-mill video, or at least it wasn't then. So I bought the book.
You can get it on Netflix now.
If I need a good laugh, it makes you laugh and cry, both. And I'm also both an adoptive and a birth mother.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I had the experience of having a second child twice, because first when I was married, I was married when I had all the children. My husband and I adopted an older child who was 10 and a half.
Oh, wow.
And we just kind of cleared three places at the cluttered dining room table instead of two, and he's hard of hearing, so we didn't really need to be quiet at night because he took off his hearing aid. And, you know, there's a lot you can do when you only have one child. And then we ended up moving to Europe, long story, another time, and we adopted a German girl who was 3 and a half younger. So she was just turning 9 as we picked her up,
uh-huh.
like 2 days later. And it was way more complicated because if you have when you have three people, you have three dyads. When you have four people, you have six dyads. So, you know, it doubled the number of two-person relationships in the family.
Oh,
and,
right. That's true.
All the things that we had ever told him that we thought he had never heard, like, don't do this, or, you know, all the rules, came out of his mouth to her. And then when we were just before we came back to the U.S., we had a birth child. And then when we got back and our marriage was on the rocks, we had a second birth child. And, again, I found that really complicated my life a lot more than the first one did. So it was very interesting.
Oh, that's interesting, because I write in the book about, you know, to me, having only one child was just impossible to I couldn't think of just having one child. Like, I really felt, in my mind, like a family has more than one kid in it, you know. I mean, technically, a family is a family. And, of course, I've changed my mind now, but I often think of that, you know, because I ended up not adopting another child. It was too much for me at the time. Huh. But I do feel sad about it. I think if I did it over again, I would have more than one. But anyway, so it's interesting to hear your perspective, because
anyway,
for me it was just a different journey, and I've accepted it now, but I have had people say, oh my God, the second one really, like, one you can kind of add to your life, but the second one really, you've just, now your whole life is your home.
The other thing is, though, if you adopted now, say a small child, you would have like two different families.
Right.
Know,
and also, like now I'm 53 and I am emotionally moving out of the caretaking attitude stage. Like I feel like I have about 5 years left in me of taking care of a kid, which is just about right. Not that I think it's over when she's 18, but I'm just saying the hands-on part of it. And I'm excited to get my life back again. I'm excited to, you know, go to concerts again and not have to think about it, and work a lot of hours and not have to think about it. Like, I'm as excited for that part of my life as I imagine as a high school person is to go to college.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. Now, I'm in Champaign. Everyone else has moved on, so no kids or grandkids here, so it's kind of weird. But this is a good town to live in. And, as far as religion, there's some very nice Friends meetings in Chicagoland. And if you like Unitarians, you might also want to check out the Friends meetings. I don't know if you have.
Quakers, you mean.
Have.
Yeah,
but,
you know, it's so funny that you mentioned that, because I was just, God, where was I just telling them about the Unitarian? And they were telling me about the Quaker meetings, too. And I had looked up some in Chicago. There isn't any in, like, Evanston, where I'm from,
yeah,
or where I am.
Yeah.
But there is in Chicago, and I really do want to check out one of those. For, like, 6 months, I went to a different church every Sunday, even if it was completely opposed to my personal beliefs, just because I found it interesting. And I didn't make it to a Quaker one, but I want to.
There is a Friends meeting in Evanston.
Oh, there
There's
is?
One in,
oh,
yeah.
God. Okay, well, I guess I missed that. I'll look that up.
Evanston, Oak Park, North Side of Chicago, 57th Street, 108th Street.
They seem to be well covered out there.
Yeah, wow. I didn't realize. I must have Googled with something too specific or something.
Well,
but I'll definitely look that up. Thank you.
I'm green something in Evanston, the Evanston meeting. So, when I got tired of the Friends meeting, I went to the Unitarians for a while, but my characterization then, which was 1980, is they're wonderful people. They support all the right political beliefs, but they don't have any spiritual center. And,
God, I get the opposite feeling. But
yeah,
anyway,
30 years later.
Each his own.
So.
Okay. Bobby, thank you very much for calling in.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. I was wondering, you covered some of this material. You had a monologue a few years back called In the Family Way.
Yes.
Which was also about adopting your daughter.
Yeah, and some of that material's in this book.
When you revisit that stuff after a few years, do your thoughts and feelings about everything stay the same, or do you find yourself...
I definitely change. You know, like, I did alter it a little. On the other hand, I also felt glad that I had written about it when it happened, because I would never have remembered any of that stuff. Sometimes I think doing this, what I've done, it's, you know, as time goes by, like with God Said Ha and In the Family Way and Letting Go of God, it kind of memorializes this one part of your life. Like, you really don't remember that much of your life. You know, like, when you think of how much life you live compared to how much really stays conscious in your brain, it's not that much. So I kind of like the fact that I've done these monologues. I didn't set out to do it this way, but it's just turned out this way.
if you went over, say you waited till you were 75 to write your memoirs,
right,
you wouldn't...
Like, I would never remember the material about Mulan falling off the chair of the airplane seat and falling onto the floor and sleeping down there, and then me forgetting that I had a baby. Like, I probably would have not remembered that at all.
You know, this is a book about personal material, and I think it's only natural that you'd stay away from writing about certain things for either your own personal reasons or protect other people. Do you have any standing rules on what you will or will not write about?
Well, no, and I wish I did. I mean, I kind of, like, I'm not going to portray, you know, my husband or daughter in a horrible light, even though, of course, like any family or person, there's moments when I see them in a negative light and have very difficult feelings. I wouldn't include that. You know, I wouldn't be mean about them. You know, like, that, I guess that's the line I would cross. I would not cross, rather. But that's, you know, there's so much more beyond that, even just portraying people in a more positive light or in a more flattering light. There's a lot of gray area, and also I struggle with the exploitive aspect of it. I mean, there's no way to get around the fact that I'm writing funny stories about my daughter, who really, well, it's hard to know because she changes her mind not only day to day but from hour to hour. But, you know, she likes it and doesn't like it, and I feel... I have mixed feelings about doing this to her. You know, like, I really have... I mean, the stories make her funny and smart, and she is funny and smart, but there is an element of exploitation to it that makes me uncomfortable, and then I feel guilty about it, and then she'll say, no, I like it, Mom. You know, like, I like you to tell the story, and then I think she's too young to even know what kind of exploitation she's dealing with. Like, so I have a lot of struggles with it, I have to say. And I kind of feel like with this book, I'm done with that. I feel like I'm done with family stuff. Like, the two things I'm working on now, one is a book of fiction, and the other is about religion. And I feel like the religion thing is just my opinions about religion and my own experiences with religion. So it's not, it's just so complicated. There is no clear line. I don't have a policy. That's my answer. There's no policy. I lurch around. I'm trying to do the best I can. On some level, I am exploiting my family. I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, I was wondering, you know, I was reading a part, and this is when I was thinking, well, maybe there's a movie in here. But as you got closer into your relationship with your with your husband, I realized I was seeing less detail about the falling in love part. You certainly make it clear that you did, but
yes.
I was wondering, was it just because it's too personal, or when everything's going good, it's just not that funny?
Well, there's actually one chapter I really wish I'd written and worked on harder for the book, and that is what it's like to be in your 50s, which is what we were, and moving in together. Like, so we had, it was, we actually had, well, it's so funny because we're getting along so well now. And we've always, I would say at any given moment, if you asked us if we were getting along great, we would say yes, because we are attracted to each other. We're both in, you know, we like each other. But now that we've, you know, we're about to celebrate our fifth anniversary in May, and now I realize that the first year was really hard because we had to learn how to be together in this house. And we weren't like young people who were like cracked eggs that you could shape any way you wanted. We were like in our 50s, and we really had lived a long time having things the way we wanted.
Two, it's not a May December marriage. It's sort of like a, I don't know.
Well, he's 5 years older than me. So
maybe a September marriage.
Yeah, exactly, a September. That's hilarious.
But
I tell him that tonight. That's really funny.
But in that case, in a May December marriage, one of them can be flexible and malleable. But it's the later you get in life, it's just harder to adjust.
Well, I think it is, and you know, and we just have very, you know, just like anybody, we have really different past experiences with family and desires about what family means, and it's just all taken a while to come together, and it is together, and I know it will last. Like it's like Mulan said something where she was like, "Do you think you guys will ever get divorced?" I go, "We're too old to get divorced. We would not have the energy to get divorced, even if we wanted to."
So you might as well stick around with each other.
Yes, exactly. But actually, I have to say, Michael's mother, Norma, said something to us that I always think of that was so great, you know, because we were both, you know, Michael, it was first marriage. He'd never been married, had no kids, and I'd been married before but didn't have kids in my previous marriage and then had been a single mom. But we're older. You know, I was, when we met, I was late 40s. He was early 50s. And she said, "The great thing about you two is that you're old enough to know that this kind of thing doesn't happen very often, but you're young enough to still enjoy it." And I love that, because not that, you know, people who are older can't enjoy it, but I just felt like we did feel young. You know, we feel young, but we're old enough to know that little things are little things.
One last unconnected thing, but it is in the book. Who is Michael Hinky Dink Kenna?
Oh, you're so cute. No one asked me about that. You're the first person, which
it's,
I think,
Chicago history, apparently.
Yes, he is. Yeah, Hinky Dink Kenna was an alderman in the first ward, which is what the different districts are called in Chicago. And my grandmother was the oldest of seven daughters, and this is like in the turn of the century, in the early 1900s. And so my dad was born in 1927 when she was 30. So I think she was born in the late 1800s. Anyway, when she was 12, and there were seven girls, and she was the oldest, her father died, and no one explained why he died. And she told me that Hinky Dink Kenna was a cousin who took care of their family after her dad died. But she didn't really go into it. But she gave me this press clipping about Hinky Dink Kenna, and I couldn't find any actual evidence that he was actually a cousin. But I always had this fond feeling for Hinky Dink Kenna, and I read a lot about him. And he was a sort of notorious alderman who looked the up. His ward had all the prostitution and all the, you know, gambling dens, and there was a lot of, you know, it was, you know, the place where you wanted a policeman to be looking the other way. And he had a partner, John Bathhouse Coughlin. He was the other alderman from the first ward.
That's certainly a name I had heard, but I don't know why.
And they kind of ran the first ward, and they were reelected every year by a huge margin for just like years and years and years. And they also owned bars and would give away free beers to somebody who could prove they voted for them. So, I mean, it was so corrupt. Anyway, so in the book, I talk about being interested in my family's genetic history, but then once I adopted Mulan, I was sort of less interested because she wasn't really part of it. But then Mulan did this, had this essay at school that was about, you know, emigration and her family and how she's a recent immigrant and her story and compared to the other stories in our past. And it just brought up all this stuff. And so I tell the story of Hinky Dink Ken. I don't know if he's actually related to me. I think he probably is not. I think my great-grandfather might have been a cop that was helped Hinky Dink out by looking the other way for a lot of unlawful activity. That's a guess, but I think so. And also they're all buried really close to me because I'm in Wilmette. 4 miles away is the cavalry. I always make that joke. My husband always goes to the cavalry cemetery where they buried all the horses from the Civil War.
Calvary.
Which is the Catholic cemetery. And all these people are buried there, including my grandmother's family, all her sisters, her parents. So I write about that in the book.
Well, at this point, we're going to have to break off. Julia Sweeney, thank you very much for being on Focus today.
Thank you so much.
I'm Jim Meadows, and you've been listening to an encore presentation of Focus on WILL. Tune in for conversations about issues and ideas that affect your life each weekday morning at 10, with a replay at 8 p.m. We welcome any additional comments or questions you have about today's show on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. This is Focus on WILL AM 580.